We're also going to look now at an announcement made just after noon. It was quite an unusual move. Representatives of the government and the opposition National Party appeared together at the podium to announce a solution to make it easier to build more bigger houses. The two parties have worked together to design new housing density rules that would allow three homes, three stories tall, on a property without resource consent. And joining me now to share his initial response is economist Brad Olson. Hi there, Brad.
Good afternoon.
I must admit, my heart sort of leapt with joy when I heard that Labor and National were going to appear to announce something together today. What was your reaction?
Oh, it's a huge move. It's really, really important to see that bipartisan support. And it does, I think, give me more confidence now that we might well be on a stronger and better pathway when it comes to housing in New Zealand. Now, let's be clear, Jesse, this is not going to be a quick fix. It's still not going to build any additional houses in the short term. But, man, it does give us a really clear steer that both sides of our sort of political system are keen to see more affordable housing, to see some of those restrictions on building being removed. This is very much a good move, and I think a really strong show of leadership from both sides to address one of the most critical problems we're seeing across Aotearoa.
Yeah, and one of the, well, I think Jane Patterson, our political editor, afternoon, after that announcement, pointing out that it gives some certainty to the decision that it's not just going to be repealed in 2 years' time if there's a new government. But also, this is just my view, but perhaps it protects both parties from losing the so-called NIMBY votes. If they're all in it together, some of the backlash around this might not be so strong or might not be felt so hard.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, looking at that, the construction sector from this announcement, it's a very firm commitment that there could well be a lot more building to be done over the next 5 years and well into the future. That, I think, gives some confidence as well to keep those pipelines healthy for building activity, keep workers on and be ready to respond to these high levels of building. I think you're right as well. Look, the political reality is that there are some people that really want to see a lot more homes and probably quite a lot of them who want to see a lot more homes, but not anywhere near them. And look, I understand that position, but we've got to get real. We've got to have more building. And what we're seeing, I think, is a reflection that New Zealand's building focus is changing. It's not so much on that sort of standalone house with a lot of backyard and similar. We're seeing a densification coming through. We're seeing a huge rise in townhouses across the country in areas that can sustain it. This policy gives a lot more action, a lot more urgency to getting housing rolled out across the country. And I think we've got to be realistic. This still means that you've got to get a building to set everything else, but it takes away some of that red tape, it speeds things up, and it does allow for a much greater focus on housing than what we've previously seen before.
Most of us don't study the regulations around housing and resource management as closely as you do, Brad. So can you tell us how significant these changes are?
Well, some of the estimates, Jesse, are putting these numbers at, you know, anywhere between, I think, 42,000 and over 100,000 additional dwellings over the next 3 to 5 years, I think it might have been. Again, remembering we've already got sort of 45,000 residential dwelling consents on the books that building companies are desperately trying to get through. So those sort of numbers, we're talking another sort of, you know, anywhere from sort of 1 to possibly another 3 years worth of additional construction moving forward. The important one for me as well is that these change in regulations, this focus on densification, could well unlock a lot more focus on prefabrication and being able to build more dwellings faster by speeding up and sort of modularising that building process. Because with this focus on densification, we can start to get some of that scale that prefabs need to be able to have more townhouses coming online. So across the board, I think this gives the sector a lot more confidence and a lot more ability to change the way that we build it and, again, refocus on the future. These changes as well being advanced, right? The National Policy Statement on Urban Development was supposed to come into place 2024. It's now coming in next year. That means that we are going to have a lot more action, a lot more stuff to do over the next 12 months or so, but it also sets a very clear line in the sand, a very clear signal that building is now much more something that we can do rather than finding any little excuse not to do it. That's a big change.
Okay. And someone on text asking, Brad, what about infrastructure? Was infrastructure even mentioned in this announcement, the roads and transport and other stuff that makes a neighbourhood worth living in? I guess no, if they're intensifying existing neighbourhoods, it's less of a problem.
To a point, we've got to still make sure we've got adequate infrastructure in those areas. You know, it might well be that there's a water pipe or so to or from a building, but if it's now servicing three, it might have to be a slightly bigger pipe to take all the stuff in and the stuff out. It's realistic, you know, that we're always needing to start somewhere. We haven't had a commitment on infrastructure yet. We haven't got clarity from either the opposition or the government over exactly what might happen in the short term and in the longer term around something like Three Waters. But this is a place to start, and you would hope that with an obvious connection between housing and infrastructure, this could well lead to a better ability to plan. And I would like to think that this could take out some of that political backlash that we often have in the housing space by allowing these sort of conversations so we can talk about infrastructure, because your messenger is absolutely right. That becomes critical for providing housing. You know, you could well build a lot of houses, but if they're sort of, you know, in the middle of nowhere with no connections, not too many people are going to be interested. Small steps to start with, but very much a step in the right direction. More work to be done.
Thanks, Brad. Nice to talk to you. Really appreciate your time today. Brad Olson is a good friend of the show, economist, and giving his response to those announcements at midday today. You have probably heard of carbon credits, but have you heard of blue carbon credits? Global environmental organisation, the Nature Conservancy, is assessing six wetland sites, coastal wetland sites in New Zealand, for their blue carbon potential. What does that mean? I'm joined by New Zealand Conservation Director Carl McGuinness. Hi there, Carl.
Hello, Jesse. How are things?
Yeah, good. What do we mean by blue carbon?
Yeah, well, I suppose most people, when they think about carbon or carbon credits, associate it with forests on the land and soil and things like that. And really with blue carbon, what we're talking about is the carbon that is in the marine and the estuarine environment, so in the salty stuff. And for us, we're talking about blue carbon as being salt marshes, mangroves and seagrass in that marine environment.
Where are you most excited about?
I think the thing that what excites me most is that a project like this hits multiple sort of interest points and outcomes. We know that salt marshes are fantastic sort of nurseries for fish. They're great for the likes of flounder, mullet, karawai, eels, whitebait, you name it. They're all in there. The great bird habitats as well, great for inverts. And then there's the mangroves that I've mentioned and seagrasses. So from a biodiversity perspective, restoring the salt marshes and the seagrass and the mangroves is a huge opportunity for us. We know what the rate of biodiversity loss is like currently. And we've lost just over 90% of our wetlands in New Zealand. Now that's both the salt marsh ones and the freshwater wetlands. But there's also carbon opportunities around wetland restoration. And that can help us address, you know, the climate problem which we're facing currently. We don't quite know exactly how much carbon these wetlands are going to store in New Zealand. But internationally, we know that the salt marshes can store up to about four times more carbon than, say, an indigenous forest. So they're great sponges for soaking up that carbon. And then the exciting bit about this is that there is also an economic benefit to it. So if we can create this sort of voluntary carbon credit around it, there's value in wetlands and it's recognising it. Biodiversity value, there's cultural value, but there's also economic value in those. And that's where this could provide a mechanism to bring some financing into those local communities who are doing wetland restoration. Or it could be sort of a help to encourage, I suppose, those farmers who might have some low-lying paddocks. They might be subject to salt incursions, which means they're sort of marginal for running stock over. But what are they like for farming carbon off? And what does that look like? So that's an exciting sort of aspect for me to look into.
So in the same way as a farmer might look at land they can't use in a productive way and plant it instead and get some value, there might be other landowners who can see a potential in land they own to be used as blue carbon and thereby get some income from it and have some sort of environmental impact too.
Yeah, exactly. I think you'll find, look, there'll be people who do the restoration regardless. It aligns with their values and it's what they want to see. But, you know, there's some who are feeling the economic pinch and say, look, I'd like to do this, but it hurts economically. So is there any way that can be eased? Well, this could be a way to say, look, rather than farming your sheep and beef on that, which might be marginal, you might be better as in regards to a land use to fence that off, to let it just go back to being a salt marsh or a mangrove. And in essence, you know, storing that carbon, claiming carbon credits off that and deriving the revenue from that.
What would need to happen from here, just quickly, Carl?
We've got a lot of work to do, Jesse, just to sort of certify that this is feasible in New Zealand. So there's a standard, a global standard that we need to meet. So we're checking how would we meet that in New Zealand. So you can say this is a valid, high-quality carbon credit. We need to check legally how would you create ownership of that and transfer it. Now, what's the scope of the opportunity? Exactly how much land is available where restoration could be an opportunity? Now, who'd want to buy it and how much would they pay for it? So those are all the sort of considerations we're going through right now as part of our sort of due diligence and feasibility.
Oh, good stuff, Carl. Thanks for raising the idea and nice to talk to you today.
Great. Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Carl McGuinness is Conservation Director from the Nature